right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, September 25th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. We made it. Oh, I always look forward to Fridays. It is 52 degrees and pretty damn cloudy here in upstate New York. But again, that's okay. It's not snowing. And that's all that matters. So if anyone has been paying attention, yes, we just saw breaking news. John Boehner is stepping down, resigning his House post in October. So what an October surprise that is. Should be fun. I don't know. I heard some rumblings last night. I don't quite know what the story is, but I'll be catching up on that one when we get off air. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Alzheimer's, CJD, Mad Cow, and Cancer. And actually, there was a much more colorful title, except that YouTube only allows you so many characters. And I couldn't put exactly what I wanted in there. But we discovered yesterday that there is a connection between food inspections, or lack thereof, good old Georgie Bush, the incompetent FDA, Congress getting rid of labels, the GMO companies, cattle farmers. What else do we connect together? We discovered that all this time, it's very possible that not only have we had malformed proteins and mad cow in our beef that we've been consuming, and at least since 2008, we found out that a federal court ruled and sided with the federal government, stating that no, even though, I don't remember the name of that farm, there was that one farm that wanted to inspect all of the beef to ensure that they didn't have mad cow disease. And they took them to court because they said it's going to be too damn expensive. And if you test for all the beef, then all the other meat packers are going to want to test for beef. Test for beef. Test for mad cow. So guess what? And a court ruled that no, they can't test every single cow because that's just not going to be good for the industry. And so all this beef, you know, randomly selected, you know, the one who starts wiggling and falling on the floor that gets carted out quickly and the heads are swapped out. Randomly selected cows are tested. And it was a very small number. I think I read something like 1,700 a year out of all the beef that we eat, consume, and export in the United States. That's all that's being tested for mad cow. But then we have this massive explosion of dementia diseases here across the United States over the last 20 years or so. I just saw, I think it's going to reach a peak around 2050. And we're going to read a story about that, this exploding dementia epidemic in the United States. But mad cow disease, which is very similar, we talked about, to the human form of CJD or CVJD, depending on which one. They're both a little bit different. Scrapie, chronic wasting disease, scrapie in sheep, chronic wasting disease that we're finding in deer, wild deer population. And now Alzheimer's, yes, yes, Alzheimer's, they came out and they discovered that not only is Alzheimer's now believed to be caused by very similar malformed proteins, amyloids, just like all those other diseases, but also that Alzheimer's may be able to be transmitted through the blood, through surgery, through dental work, in other things that we do every single day. But wait, it gets even better, because we also discovered, and we knew this back from the days of mad cow, that because it's a malformed protein and it's not a bacteria, it's not a virus, it's not fungal, traditional sterilization procedures do not work on instruments. So for the last 20 plus years, at least, it's very possible that these malformed proteins have been in our food supply, have been in our bodies. People have been infected. There's been surgeries and blood transfusions. And I mean, what about donated blood, for God's sakes? and it's transmissible from person to person, people that come into contact with that tissue or with that blood or with that bodily fluid. I mean, absolutely, I see a mega epidemic coming if that's the case, and that's where the research is all pointing. If you hit the show yesterday, it's up on UCY's YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/UCYTV, no dot. And hit the before the first cup Alzheimer's, CJD, mad cow, and cancer, and go into the description. I probably put 50 links of evidence of stuff that I stitched together. And there's stuff we talked about yesterday. There's also stuff we didn't talk about because it was after the show, but it was definitely pointing to something that we were talking about. And you need to go through those because it was highly disturbing. We have a big problem, Clyde, with our food supply. And it got even worse than that because then we continued on. It was bovine day yesterday. We continued on and we looked at this new thing that I'd never heard about until just a few days ago, but apparently they'd known about it since, I think the original date they discovered it was in Lithuania in like 1871. It's the bovine leukemia virus. But they identified it in United States cows and European cows back in the end of the 1960s. In Europe and other countries, they culled all the cows that had this bovine leukemia virus and they tried to get it out of the food chain. But in the United States, they did not. And because of that, and we'd read actual CDC documentation that had stated that 100%, 100%, not 1, not 10, not even 90%, 100% of farms of 500 cows or more. So we're talking commercial operations. Their vats of milk and their cows are infected with bovine leukemia virus. And it gets even better because the bovine leukemia virus, and they also said that some dairy cows go into the food supply, which I never knew that. I didn't know that they actually use dairy cows for meat at some point. I mean, maybe Bessie's getting a little old. She's not working out too well. Whoop to the meat grinder for you, Bessie. But there was a percentage of dairy cows that go into the food supply as well. And then they found that even smaller farms with less than 100 cows, I think the number was, had a 35% infection rate. And all this time, since the 1970s, they were basing their testing for safety because they just let that all go. They let it all go into the food supply. And we've been consuming bovine leukemia virus at least since they found it in the late 60s in our milk and other dairy products. So I'd assume cheeses as well. But it gets even better because they discovered now in a study, they're finding bovine leukemia virus in breast cancer. And now they're wondering if it's even possible that it could cause leukemia in humans. Well, the last testing they did was in the 70s. And in the 70s, with their 70s equipment, they determined that no, it doesn't affect humans, and no, it's fine to go into the food supply. So here we've been drinking, eating, and consuming this bovine leukemia for 40 years with the blessing of our food safety agencies. I had talked about how just absolutely ludicrous it is to even think that we have a food safety or inspection division in this country. An FDA, a USDA, they're not doing jack shit to make sure that your food is safe. Oh, what? You know, I always joke about it, but it's true. It's called the sniff test. They're sniffing not just seafood coming out of the Gulf of Mexico to see whether or not it's contaminated with Corexit. And yeah, they are. The nose knows. That's the name of the article. And that's an official .gov article, by the way. But they're also doing it with foods that are being inspected by the FDA. Now, another thing back a week or two ago, we discovered, so all this stuff has been blessed. We got mad cow, We're not testing for it. We got bovine leukemia virus. Don't worry about it. We're not going to tell you, but we don't think it affects humans. Whoops, 40 years later, it may. And whoops, mad cow is maybe transmissible with malformed prions through standard medical procedures. But we also find out that back in 2008, they gave the rubber stamp to cloned animals being in the food supply without requiring any labels whatsoever. Because, you know, again, don't worry about it. We did all of our homework and our research, and we're pretty sure, at least now, right now, that it's not going to cause any future problems. Eat it, shut up, and we'll let you know in 40 years when we finally do a study. I mean, how is this keeping you safe? It was just something else I was thinking about in the food, and it just flitted away. But here, I want to check out a couple stories because I know I talk about this stuff all the time. Oh, and then we find out, right? We already knew this about all the FDA fraudulent research. So anything that they put in writing, I don't believe one single word of it anyway. All right. We read this story probably about a year ago, and I've referenced it many, many, many times. But I want to illustrate to you, and maybe you remember it, maybe you don't, but too bad. We're going to read it again because it's very important. I want to illustrate to you how even more insidious this whole dark act, getting rid of labeling on food, for GMOs, making it voluntary, just like labeling your food as cloned meat is voluntary. How many companies are going to put a big fat label on it that says, I'm cloned? Call me, I don't know, call me Bessie number 379. But how many companies are going to voluntarily label anything? So we have this dark act that's all about GMOs and synthetic biology getting into the food chain. They're calling it the Safe Act or something like that. The food, oh, I'll look it up. It's some ridiculous name that is completely opposite of what the actual act is. And don't think that that isn't by design either. But then we also have them getting rid of, and they did, the country of origin label. We got sued by Canada and Mexico because we were labeling the beef per a law we had on the books as to what country it came from. And they cried foul and they went to the World Trade Organization and said, hey, it's not fair. You can't tell them where your meat comes from. We don't want them knowing that this is Mexican hamburger, Canadian, and I think it was all meat. Canadian chicken. It was beef, pork, and chicken. And so they sued us through the World Trade or whatever they call it. You know, they started an action against the United States, and the World Trade Organization ruled on it, and they told us that the country of origin labels, a law that we put on our books, was illegal according to international law. Welcome to the 21st century globalist world. Illegal to tell me where my beef comes from? According to some global organization I don't give two shits about and I had nothing to do with getting in power. What is that? You know, we also found out, and this is what I kept forgetting, was the whole Chinese chicken thing. I mean, I know it's a joke, and I make fun of Chinese chicken all the time. Who wants to eat anything from China? I just saw a story yesterday about Australia having major issues with food and the safety of food when the inspectors actually inspect them in Australia with food that comes from China. But, you know, that Chinese chicken, they rubber stamped that as well. And they said, hey, you know what? We decided that if a manufacturer wants to send all their chickens to China, have them be called, diced and sliced and put into processed food, or even just called and wrapped up and shipped back here, we're going to give you the blessing. We're not going to tell anyone it's happening. And guess what? You don't have to label it. Oh, what? You don't have to label Chinese chicken. Nope. And if you find it economical to have your soup made in China and boil that chicken, make that chicken broth, make that beef stock with those beef bones that we kind of decided didn't have mad cow wink, and then ship it back to the United States, it's just fine with us. So, okay, let's take a look here. That chipmunk is back. I think he likes me talking. He lives under the step outside the door. All right, inspectors, and this is the FDA. Inspectors struggle to keep up with food with a flood of imports. The FDA physically inspects only about 2% of all food imports. So we have this shortage of FDA inspectors to begin with. Now, I had seen a story probably a month or two ago talking about, of course, all this newfangled technology that they're going to start using. We have newfangled technology everywhere where they're going to start doing some sort of like DNA analysis of foods that come in. But again, they don't open every carton. They only open select numbers. So now we have this flood of imports coming in from all these countries around the world, and we didn't have enough inspectors to begin with. And we're going, well, hey, and I've told you, the country of origin does their own inspecting. And what happens is they create a quote-unquote food inspection agency in that country, and then we apparently send someone over to go inspect it. And they go, yeah, blessings. It's up to the United States standards of inspection. You just keep doing what you're doing, ship your food to us, and we'll give it a blessing. And that's what happens. So, all right, let's read a little bit of this. And I don't know how far I want to go. This is a long story, and it's an old one. So we'll just kind of touch on this. So we have this flood of imports. We're struggling to keep up. It says in, where do we start? The shipments were flagged for inspection, blah, blah, blah. The FDA reported that in 2010, it refused nearly 16,000 food-related shipments out of the more than 10 million that arrived in the United States in 320 different ports. If it comes in here and it's bad, we're going to get them, except when they don't. Myriad critics, including the U.S. Government Accountability Office, that's the GAO, says that the FDA, so this is the federal government pointing to another division of the federal government saying, hey, the FDA is simply not up to the task of ensuring the safety of food imports, which are entering this country in ever-growing numbers. The FDA expects 24 million shipments of FDA-regulated goods to pass through the nation's ports of entry this year, and this must have been 2011, up from 6 million just a decade ago. And during that time, the number of FDA investigators had stayed constant. Within the last 10 years, they didn't hire anybody. There's only 1,350 inspectors for 320 ports. For expected, in 2011, 24 million shipments. And this is just coming in imports. The agency began adding investigators in 2009, and they now have 1,800. Whew, good thing. Still far short of the number required to keep up pace with imports. And in 2010, FDA inspectors physically examined only 2.06% of all food-related imports. The agency expects, oh my God, the agency expects to inspect only 1.59% of all food imports this year, and even less, 1.47% next year. Nobody is watching the store. All right, now let's look at a couple of tests. The very first one, sensory tests. The nose, yes, the nose. The nose prepares to sniff his way down a my filet. Steve Angold works out of a narrow lab at the FDA's brand new $40 million testing facility in Irvine, California. What do they got, like gold toilet seats there? I mean, you spent $40 million on a facility, yet you didn't hire 10,000 inspectors He is one of about 25 FDA sniffing. He's a sniffing specialist across the country who rely on, oh, I guess it's more than sniffing, senses of sight, touch, taste, and smell to detect decomposition or filth in food products. So he's just using his nose, his eyes, his tongue, and his fingers to determine how good your food is. It's either a pass or fail, he says. Ocean grimy smells would be passing. Even stale or fishy odors would be passing. But if the food smells like turnips or cabbage, it's probably spoiled, he said. Oh, my God. And the worst smells, he adds, are fecal. Yes. Fecal smells in food. Some people refer to it as baby diapers, but I don't have kids. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, my God. A few doors down, entomologist John Sedwick places a sample of sugarcane under the microscope, and he moves the petri dish slowly under the lens until he spots black ants. Some of them whole, some cut in half. All of them are dead in the particles of sugar. The FDA is tolerant of ants and other field insects that get mixed in with food prior to harvesting because they pose little threat to human health. Yeah, you know, did anyone think of what if they were coated with insecticides? Nah, don't worry about it. We don't spray bug sprays on bugs anywhere, everywhere in the United States. Investigators are uncertain, but they can consult the, quote, food defect action levels manual that sets out exactly how many insect parts, larvae, or animal hairs are acceptable. Yes, good old rat hairs in your peanut butter. Other things like blowfly maggots, cockroaches, and they carry a whole host of foodborne pathogens such as bacteria and viruses as well as parasites. So there's a wide, very low tolerance for those kinds of insects, but entomologists are looking for anything that a human would find repulsive or aesthetically displeasing. Yeah, I guess we find ant parts, larvae, and rat hairs just fine. He continues, I've had samples where I found rat hair, shrew hair, bat hair, beetles, and maggots all in the same sample. So I sure hope he didn't rubber stamp that one. So what do we do when one of these guys, so we're doing all this manually and we're only inspecting like 1% of all the food. What do we do when they have a bad day? What do they do? What do we do when they look at it and they're like, well, the limits are 10,000 parts per ounce, and I got 9,988 parts per ounce. I'm going to pass it. And this is just, for somebody who's as anal about their food as I am, all this stuff is just absolutely horrifying to me. Yesterday, I almost didn't eat dinner after that whole beef thing. It was, I don't even know what to say. We need to start growing and cultivating our own food. It's very obvious. I mean, despite the GMO thing, that was kind of where the whole mantra came from, but it's way worse than GMOs. It says, those are the food products that the FDA rejects, either ordering the food to be destroyed or returned to the country it came from. And I read a story yesterday. Another thing that they do with that food that's been rejected, by the way, is they have it processed into animal feed. Yes. All right, we're going to continue on to a different story. So that was about FDA inspections. I found an article on the USDA website yesterday about their import procedures for milk, poultry, and egg products. This is the USDA Safety and Inspection Service, FSIS, is responsible for ensuring that domestic and imported meat, poultry, and egg products are safe, wholesome, and accurately labeled. Well, we know that none of that is true. There's no labels anymore. Dark Act and country of origin removed. We know the products aren't necessarily safe because of the mad cow and the bovine leukemia virus. And wholesome, high fructose corn syrup and 90% of all the food we eat does not make something wholesome. Foreign countries that export meat, poultry, and egg products to the United States are required to establish and maintain inspection systems that are equivalent to those of the United States. And this is what I was talking about. They are inspecting their own foods. The FSIS, and that is the Food Safety Inspection Service Division of the USDA, audits foreign inspection systems and re-inspects meat and poultry at the port of entry to ensure that foreign countries have maintained equivalent inspection systems. Except we find out, yeah, they inspect it when it's imported, but what, 1% like the FDA is doing? Foreign countries undergo a stringent review process before they become eligible to or export meat. What, like China? The fact that China has been rubber stamped to import and export our meat. I don't know who was responsible for proving that, but how is it possible with all the stuff we know about China and it being one of the most polluted places in the entire world? I would say don't eat anything out of China or India. You know, very, very polluted places. I'm sure that on everybody's shoes, you got chemicals. I don't know. I mean, those, China especially is a country where, you know, when you have companies that are putting antifreeze into children's toothpaste because it's a little bit cheaper than the one molecule off sweetening agent that's almost like antifreeze, but it isn't toxic. But it's more expensive than antifreeze. We had a Chinese company putting antifreeze as a sweetening agent into children's toothpaste. We're going to trust them, giving them a rubber stamp on their inspection facilities to ship meat back to this country? I don't think so. Says countries are not required to adopt an identical inspection system. Rather, they must just have an equivalent one. So, all right, let's mince some words. The evaluation of a country's inspection system is to determine eligibility involves two steps. That is a document review and an on-site audit. Is that singular? The document review is an evaluation of the country's laws, regulations, and other written information focusing on 5 risk areas. And yeah, you could put any bullshit on paper. Doesn't matter. And, you know, just copy and paste from whatever the United States says that we do. It'll be close enough. Sanitation controls, animal disease controls, slaughter and processing controls, residual controls, and enforcement controls. And I mean, when we look at animal disease and slaughter and processing, we know how well that works here. If the document review process shows that the country's system is equivalent, then a technical team will be dispatched to that country to evaluate those 5 risk areas, as well as other aspects of the inspection system, including plant facilities and equipment, laboratories, training programs, and in-plant inspection operations. And yeah, of course, they probably give you a whole month's notice to plan for the trip so you can make sure everything's in order. I mean, anyone who's worked in corporate America and had any type of upper management coming to do an on-site inspection, you know exactly how that is. On your best behavior and do everything precisely correct while they're there. If the team deems the inspection system to be equivalent to the U.S. system, a proposed rule is published in the Federal Register announcing the determination and the intent to list the country as an eligible country to export meat, poultry, or egg products to the United States. And then after consideration of public comments, of course, all those public comments, I don't remember anyone asking me to comment on Chinese chicken. A final decision is made on the country eligibility, and if favorable, a final rule is issued. And that foreign country's inspection system is then responsible for certifying individual exporting establishments and for providing annual recertification documentation. The inspection service regularly then conducts on-site audits of the eligible foreign inspection systems to ensure that they remain equivalent to the U.S. I wonder if they do surprise visits. I mean, what is this? So we're, I mean, yeah, I guess it's better to have them inspecting food foreignly than not. But on the other hand, I don't think that we can test any of these places. It says they do reinspection at port entry upon arrival of a U.S. port of entry. All meat and poultry shipments must be reinspected by an FSIS import inspector before they are allowed into this country, and every lot of product is given a visual inspection for appearance and condition. So that must be that one specialist guy we read about. There's only, how many did they say there were? There weren't very many of them in the United States for the FDA. But I mean, what's a visual inspection? So we look at it, we're like, yeah, that's fish. It smells like fish. And they are checked for certification and label compliance. In addition, and this is where some of this new stuff is coming, automated import information systems assign various other types of inspection, including product examination and microbial and chemical laboratory analysis. Egg products are reinspected at the facility where they are taken for further processing, and about 65 inspectors. 65 inspectors carry out reinspection at 150 official import establishments. So I don't know what happened to the 320 or whatever that number was that they said for the FDA, but apparently the USDA only has about 150 of them. Shipments that pass reinspection are allowed to enter the U.S. commerce and are treated. They're treated. Now get this. Shipments that come in and they give them the blessing are treated as domestic products. And hey, now that we've gotten rid of the country of origin labeling, who's gonna know if it's not domestic products? And shipments from all countries except for Canada are stamped with the official USDA mark of inspection. So that inspection mark doesn't mean jack shit. What? The USDA inspected it, maybe, but it might have been inspected by Chinese inspectors and then sent here and had a visual test and then was randomly selected at some point to be chemically and microbially analyzed. But what did they say? 46 million shipments? And we got 65 inspectors at 150 ports. Canadian shipments carry the Canadian mark of inspection and an export stamp, and I'll bet you it won't anymore now that those country of origin laws are gone. And if a shipment does not meet U.S. requirements, the containers are stamped U.S. refused entry, and within 45 days must either be exported, and this is what I was saying, destroyed, or converted to animal food, if an appropriate request for diversion is approved by the FDA. Oh, too many bovine, gangly, neurological products in this shipment that can't be eaten. Maybe we'll just put it in the cat food. For imported egg products, the first 10 shipments only of each foreign plant is tested at the destination facility to establish a history of compliance. And this rate is then reduced to a random selection of 1 in 8 production lots as long as the product continues to be in compliance. And each production lot is subjected to organoleptic inspection as well as evaluation of labeling. I guess that must be the official word for the sensory test, organoleptic. In order to export to the United States, a foreign country must have a residual control program with U.S. with standards equivalent to the U.S., and statutes require that foreign residual programs include random sampling of animals at slaughter, the use of approved sampling and analytic methods, testing of appropriate target tissues for specific compounds, and testing for compounds identified by the USDA or country of origin as potential contaminants. All right, we're going to cruise down to the bottom here. Import statistics, and it seems that nowhere do we have any real-time statistics. That first story from the FDA was talking about 2010 and before. This one talks about 2008, and this is from the USDA's website. In fiscal year 2008, the FSIS inspected 3.3 billion pounds of imported meat and poultry from 29 countries, most of which was fresh and processed meat, only a small amount of poultry was imported. Yeah, that was in 2008, until they ruled that it was legal to import Chinese chicken or send U.S. chicken there, have it processed and sent back. This represents less than 10% of the domestic meat supply. And during the fiscal year of 2008, 21.7 million pounds of egg products were imported from Canada, the only country that exports eggs to the United States. And that's untrue, since the bird flu massive culling of 46 million birds and Iowa's big shortage of eggs, they also allowed French eggs to come in. And I thought there was another country. And a lot of our eggs were going to have to be imported. And what I can't even believe is with these old ass statistics on here, it says at the very bottom of this document that this document was modified April 16th, 2014. So apparently they don't have any new statistics. So, all right, now let's get to some of the stuff that I wanted to hit on. So we talked about yesterday with all this disease in our food supply and stuff that's been in there forever that they apparently didn't know about. And GMO running rampant, and we find out that there's all kinds of stuff, edible vaccines that they'd been messing with since the 80s or early 90s, tomato, potato, banana, apple, and there was one other one. Wow, all this shit is just spinning on my page. And with these vaccines that they're putting all this recombatant DNA in, aborted fetal DNA, we also have scientists discovering that that DNA gets absorbed into our DNA and can be causing problems. And there's questions now about the DNA and some of the synthetic stuff that's in the vaccines, some of the synthetic stuff that's in our food. Wow, it looks like I'm going to have some major issues here. All right, let's see if we can play this. We are going to try to see, I don't know. The second I come out here, everything goes to shit. Hey, maybe we can. All right, we're going to check out our good old friend Jeffrey Smith from the Institute for Responsible Technology. If anything even loads, I don't know if this is possible. Come on, Jeffrey. Jeffrey. I have three machines in slow syrup mode right now. And Google keeps telling me that it needs to put something on my hard drive. It's only the second time I've seen that. All right. And we have no volume. So, uno momento, por favor. Let's check all the...
Oh.
That explains why.
But look at, I have the echo back. And this is a different machine.
The machine that never had an echo. All right, good old Jeffrey Smith, founder of the Institute for Responsible Technology, discussing GMO apples and potatoes.
The Institute for Responsible Technology. The United States Department of Agriculture just approved a non-browning apple, nicknamed the Botox apple. It hides its age because even if it's sliced and left out for close to 3 weeks, it won't turn brown. Similarly, a potato, engineered not to brown or bruise. Now, obviously, there's a concern that you may be tricked into eating a very old, possibly even rotten, apple or potato. But scientists around the world are concerned about something far more serious. The genes that produce the browning in the apple and the potato are silenced through something called double-stranded RNA. The engineers put in DNA into the apple's genome. It produces a double-stranded RNA, which then silences the gene that normally causes the apple or potato to brown. Now, what they're concerned about is that the double-stranded RNA produced in the apple and in the potato may silence our genes accidentally. A perfect example of this happened in an experiment on honeybees. Scientists took double-stranded RNA, selected specifically not to have an effect. Unfortunately, they got it all wrong. They fed a single meal of double-stranded RNA to these honeybees, and 1,461 genes changed their levels of expression. That's about 10% of all the genes in the honeybee. Now, the author said this certainly changed the physiology, development, and behavior of the honeybees.
I'm in a stat. 1,400 genes changed. I mean, this is our point. This mad science, we don't have any long-term studies in anything. Now, guess what we do have long-term studies in? We have long-term studies, future long-term studies, of what's going to happen to people who consume bovine leukemia virus in their dairy products and potentially in their beef for the last 40 years. Oh, I bet that's going to become a big new research study. We also are going to have long-term studies as to what happens when 20, 40 years of people have been eating beef infected with malformed prions.
And it was a complete surprise to the scientists.
It's always a complete surprise, it seems, isn't it? Oh, wow, we didn't know.
We're going to be surprised by the effect of the double-stranded RNA found in the apple and in the potato.
But here's the best part. They found this out, but guess what? They released the GMO apple and the potato to the market. And whoops, we don't have to label anything anymore. I've already seen that GMO potato, and I knew because it had all this marketing on it about it. We don't go brown. We don't have brown spots or little eye things. We're perfect, and we last forever.
Surprisingly, the form of RNA called double-stranded RNA is very, very stable.
By the way, this is a professor of genetics at the University of Canterbury speaking, Dr. Jack Heineman.
Stable than we think of for normal RNA molecules. And it's now been shown that they can be taken up after digestion of the food into our blood supply.
Now, if we have a few minutes when this is done, we are going to look at you are what you eat and this DNA and RNA being absorbed into our own.
We also know that other animals take up these double-stranded RNA molecules. And in fact, there are biotech companies who specifically engineer crops to produce double-stranded RNA molecules that are lethal to insects and crop pests.
And that's the new technology that Monsanto is developing, this RNAi insecticide. Basically, it flips switches on and off in the bug that stops it from producing some required nutrient for life, so they just wither and die slowly.
Until now, mostly the companies and the regulatory community have rejected the need to test these double-stranded RNA molecules based on the argument that they did not expect double-stranded RNA to survive digestion and be taken up in the blood system. Now that that assumption, which was never tested, has been challenged by peer-reviewed scientific evidence and has also been confirmed by two subsequent studies using other types of analysis, it's important that the regulatory community change its tune on this and demand that the companies demonstrate using experiments that the unintended or intended double-stranded RNA molecules made in genetically engineered organisms don't have an adverse effect on consumers.
You think? Oh, my God. Well, you know what? We don't think it's going to affect anybody. Like, just like the bovine leukemia virus and the mad cow. We didn't think it was going to bother anybody, so we just let it go. Wink, is we're all invested, and there's a revolving seat between regulatory agencies and genetically modified companies and the beef industry and the agriculture department. I mean, it's just disgusting.
In 2013, Dr. Jack Heineman and others published a comprehensive paper describing how to evaluate the risks of double-stranded RNA so it's not a danger to us. Soon after, United States Department of Agriculture entomologists published their paper citing Heineman's work and agreeing that the risks were severe and that the current assessments were incompetent to evaluate those risks and protect the environment and health.
Wow, the USDA actually agreed?
Tragically, the government regulators around the world ignore the risks. They even ignore the recommendations of their own scientists. The perfect example is found at the United States Food and Drug Administration. There, the scientists repeatedly warned that GMOs were different and dangerous, and could lead to allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They urge their superiors to require long-term study. But the person in charge of policy, Michael Taylor, Monsanto's former attorney, later Monsanto's vice president, and now back at the FDA as the U.S. food czar. His policy, he was in charge of, declared that the agency was not aware of any information showing that GMOs were different, a lie. And on the basis of that lie, no safety testing was necessary and no labeling was necessary.
And that's what I've been saying. An apple is an apple. A potato is a potato. A tomato is a tomato. They've been rubber stamping it all.
The policy came out in 1992, but we didn't know it was a lie for many years until the court ordered the FDA to reveal these secret documents.
So 1992, and it's now 2015. So how many years is that? A good 25 plus years that we have, almost 30 years that we have, no, 25 years that we now have long-term studies that we've been consuming this shit and nobody knew.
Millions of Americans are set to be exposed as early as 2016 when these things go to market.
And this is, he's talking about the potato and the apple, and the potatoes are already on the market. I'm telling you, it's the J.R. Simplot potato that doesn't brown.
We don't know if the double-stranded RNA produced in these GMOs will match the sequence of our genes and change their levels of expression. It could be quite dangerous if it does. We don't want to be the guinea pigs. The Institute for Responsible Technology will not stand by and simply let this happen. Will you? Please sign our petition.
And I mean, petitions aren't going to change anything. They're doing it anyway. And that is the horror of all of this. This has been, and this isn't new either. You know, we act like, oh my God. But I mean, this has been happening for at least 40 years. And if you want to even go back further, let's go back and look at some of the vaccines that they knew were going to damage people. When we went back to the original swine flu back in the 70s, they had that expose out of 60 Minutes with the scientist at the CDC that had come right out and had told his superiors, and it was documented, that it caused neurological issues, and they ignored any recommendations and let it go anyway. Oh, all right, so here, let's look at Science Daily really quick. Feed your genes. How our genes respond to the food we eat. What should we eat? Well, answers abound in the media, blah, blah, blah. But what if you could answer this question at a molecular level? What if you could eat? What if you could find out how your genes respond to the foods we eat and what this does to the cellular processes that makes us healthy or not? That is precisely what biologists at Norwegian University of Science and Technology have done. If you could ask your genes to say what kind of foods are best for your health, they would have a simple answer: one-third protein, one-third fat, and one-third carbohydrates. And that is what recent genetic research from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology shows is the best recipe to limit your risk for most lifestyle-related diseases. Researcher Ingrid Arbu and Hans Richard Brock have fed slightly overweight people different diets and studied the effects of this on gene expression. And gene expression refers to the process where information from a gene's DNA sequence is translated into a substance like a protein that is used in a cell structure or function. This affects not only the genes that cause inflammation in the body, which was originally part what we wanted to study, but also genes associated with the development of cardiovascular disease, some cancers, dementia, and type 2 diabetes, all the major lifestyle-related diseases. You know, and what's so amazing about this is what we've been saying. The DNA that's in food that we consume, that we put into our body, fuels the metabolic process in our body. And if it makes it through the digestive system and it's absorbed into our bloodstream, it directly affects your cells. It directly affects your DNA. So all these poisons that we're ingesting, and now we're finding out, oh my God, we could have this leukemia infection and we could have this malformed protein. And we have all this GMO that's running rampant out there, and glyphosate and spray on RNA we heard about. I mean, where is this going to end? And when we hear the clip from RT then that we kicked the show off with yesterday about the new human 2.0 just randomly appearing out of nowhere in the next 30 years, it all totally starts to make sense. Hold on. There was one more thing I want to hit. Here, let me kill Skype because we got the hiss in the background. America in 2050, this is out of the week. America's future dementia epidemic. So now we see this coming in 2014. It was a big year for medicine. The unprecedented Ebola outbreak, quote unquote. And of course, the Ebola outbreak is where we trialed our new RNAi vaccines. Woo! On people, mind you. The release of a report showing an increase in antibiotic resistance diseases worldwide. Yes. And there was an executive order that came out last July because of that. And then a spike in the American measles cases from parents opting out of vaccines made all the headlines. Yes. Johnny's vacation was ruined because we had some parents with half a brain that took a look at all the crazy shit they're putting in vaccines and said, wait a second, how's that going to affect my kid? And opted out of it. But we're the dangers. The people that are questioning the cash cow of the precision medicine future of America, the genomics capital of slicing and dicing and putting you in the database to become the real-time $29.99 a month software as a service information to get rid of the R&D line item budget for these pharmaceutical companies as a guinea pig. Yeah, those crazy people. Says yet researchers studying a quieter but no less deadly disease also had something to say. A team at Rush Institute for Healthy Aging released findings that showed that cases of Alzheimer's disease, a neurological condition that gradually robs a sufferer of their mental abilities, would increase considerably as the American population aged. Wow, what a mystery. The report, which was put together using calculations that took data from a Chicago sample and extrapolated it nationwide using census data, showed that an estimated 1.6 million Americans aged 65 or older would die from Alzheimer's in 2050. That would account for a 43% of older adult deaths in this country. And by contrast, 32% of older adult deaths were due to disease in 2010. So Alzheimer's is going to overtake disease as the biggest killer of Americans here in the next decade or two. And it's not that Alzheimer's is somehow becoming more virulent. No, not at all. In fact, some studies indicate that Americans are at less risk of developing the disease because the rates of heart disease and stroke are also going down. Well, what a dumbass thought that is. just because stroke and heart disease are going down that they just assume. Again, let's not do any studies. Let's pass it off as science, and then let's point fingers at those tinfoil hat-wearing lunatics that are questioning our broken logic. Instead, it's the demographics that are leading the shift. By 2030, 20% of the American population will be 65 or older, and barring any unforeseen changes in the disease or a cure, that means roughly 13 million older Americans could suffer from Alzheimer's disease by 2050. And when I look at this curve, it is going straight up. And of course, when they now announce that malformed proteins from all these other brain-wasting diseases that were out there, including the bovine spongiform encephalopathy. See, I got to say it today. Very similar. And that, whoops, they were ruled federally that they didn't have to inspect all the cows. We can exactly see how this number is going to go way up. But hey, guess what? There's tons of money and tons of research going on how to cure what ails you. Alzheimer's and cancer are the two big funded studies, and that's going to be the cash cow of the 21st century. All right, guys. Well, guess what? We definitely are getting to the end of the show here. I don't know. My clock doesn't launch. We got about a minute left. I found what I was talking about yesterday. I thought it was Sesame Street, but it wasn't. It was a public service announcement that when I was a kid, I remember when I was eating my tuna fish, watching my fish, and they told me, you are what you eat. Let's see if it launches. I hope it does. Hurry up before the music comes on.
Hi there, time for Timer, your roving reporter. I'm talking to you from inside a fantastic factory, your digestive system. You know what we build here? You. Not out of wood or metal, but out of food. You see, you are what you eat from your head down to your feet. Things like meat and eggs and fish you need to build up muscle tissue. Uh-oh. Hello, appetite control, more protein. We need energy. Playing tennis today, you know. Whoops. All the...
Okay, and it's about the end of the show. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. We have Ms. Lonnie Clark live up next. 6 p.m., Josh is live. At 8, Timer Time, replay with Michael and Nick. 9, Truth on the Tracks, Brandon. 10, Reality Bites, brand new with Neil.